Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a heart-wrenching crisis in Europe, jail time for a Kentucky clerk, Trump pledges allegiance to the GOP, takes heat from Jeb, and the Iran nuclear deal has the votes to go through. Suffering and standoff in Europe over refugees, migrants piling in from Syria, desperate.
Imagine yourself in our place. You are a human. We are a human. You have kids. We have kids.
A Kentucky county clerk is behind bars for her refusal to issue marriage licenses to gay couples.
Why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under
why? Authority.
Whose authority?
Under God's authority.
And Jeb Bush cuts loose on Donald Trump. Here he is at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire.
Donald Trump's view is that the end is near. His pessimistic view is, let's close the borders, let's create tariffs, let's do this, let's do that, all based on negativity. And the net result is that all of us will suffer if that philosophy gains favor.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Stefan Gorobi of Euro News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on, what should Europe do? Why is Trump pledging not to bolt? And what about that Kentucky clerk, that Tom Brady? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington today is Stefan Gorobi. He is the Washington correspondent for Euro News. And man, has Europe been in the spotlight this week. Stefan, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back. Thanks for being here today.
It's always great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Stefan, and Karen.
Absolutely heart-wrenching, heart-rending images and realities out of Europe this week. Everybody at this point has heard about or seen the three-year-old on the beach of the Aegean, five children dead there, didn't even make it into Greece. Syrian, Kurd in that case. Many did make it as far as Budapest. The scenes in the railway station there, just horrible. Seemed like something out of World War II era. Here's a Syrian migrant, Mohammed, talking with Agence France-Presse on Wednesday outside Budapest main railway station.
We need our rights. We need our rights to cross this station. And it's not our dream to stay here and to sleep on the streets. We'll have normal people, educated, non-educated, doctors, engineers, any people. We're staying here until we go with the train to Germany.
Just terrible scenes there. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban Thursday at a press conference. He's been saying a lot, saying the Christian basis of Hungary and Europe's life is under threat. He's saying this is not a European problem, it's a German problem.
The problem is not a European problem. The problem is a German problem. Nobody would like to stay in Hungary, neither in Slovakia, nor Poland, nor Estonia. All of them would like to go to Germany.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel, not so sure. It's just a German problem. She said that they're very open to taking a lot of migrants, but said all of Europe has to get in on this, or else they might have to go to some reconsideration of a fundamental of the EU, that is the open borders, the sort of passport-free, what's called the Schengen zone. Here's Merkel.
I am simply saying that if we are unable to agree on a fair distribution of refugees within Europe, then some people will start to call Schengen into question. We do not want that. We want a fair distribution of refugees, and then we won't need to discuss Schengen.
More on the line than just the migrants, the refugees, the future of the EU itself in some ways looking on the line here. Stefan Gorobi, is there any solution in sight to this standoff we've seen all this week and the suffering that's come with it?
Well, I think we're going to see some solutions at the end of the day. But with all things European, it's terribly complicated, and it's a very complex issue here. And we see once again the continental divide and the divisions between the left and the right in Europe, the rich and the poor states, and the East and the West. Now, the problem isn't old. It was pretty predictable. I mean, the civil war in Syria has been going on for quite a while. And by now, these poor people have made their way up to the gates of Europe, to Central Europe. And what happens is that, unfortunately, they have to deal with a government in Hungary that is overwhelmed, to put it mildly, maybe even incompetent to deal with it.
Why is Hungary stopping them, Stefan? Why not just wave them through? They want to go to Germany. Hungary doesn't want them. Why not just let them go on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not?
Ask them. They're not, because this is a right-wing government that has seen its controversies and standoffs with Brussels, even with the United States in the past. And this is a government that is hiding behind bureaucratic and legalistic principles here, instead of doing what, you know, common sense would dictate and let these people go to Germany.
Is Germany sending them a message? Is Germany saying, don't send them on to us? We don't want you, keep them right. You stop them there. Is Germany saying that behind the scenes?
Germany is saying exactly the opposite. And being German, I couldn't be prouder of this government. They're saying, well, we accept probably up to 800,000 refugees out of the civil war area this year. They say, we accept them. We'll find a place for them. And now we have to deal with the first aid issues here. And then we talk about the long-term prospects. But Germany has become a very, very tolerant and open society. And I was so proud hearing these Syrian refugees chanting, Germany, Germany, we want freedom. And Urban is right. Nobody wants to stay in Hungary.
I mean, you go back to World War II, and of course, Germany was not where desperate refugees wanted to go, quite the opposite. But now Germany's saying, come on, Hungary, stopping them right there. Karen Tumulty, if this is about sharing the burden of migrants, refugees coming out of the war zone in Syria, is the United States immune to that call?
Well, on two levels, you know, there is the question of what to do with the refugees, but there's also the question where I think the United States and a number of countries have been accused of being paralyzed, which is what to do about the civil war in Syria that is driving all these people out there. And I do think that the, you know, this tragic photo of this beautiful toddler on the beach in a pose that, you know, should have been a nap.
Yeah, and dressed so nicely. And I mean, this was a child anybody could relate to.
And it reminds me of a moment as I was thinking about what the United States' response might be. It reminds me of a moment in 1995 where there was a picture of a woman in Srebrenica who had been raped and who hung herself from a tree. And this picture of this woman was on every newspaper front page just about in the world. And it was at that moment that President Clinton was trying to figure out whether he should do airstrikes. And Vice President Gore went into a national security meeting and said, look, I cannot explain to my daughter Karenna, when she asked me why we're not doing anything, why we are here paralyzed when this is happening. And again, it was one image of one woman who really became a symbol of, you know, what was happening to thousands and thousands of people.
Stefan, Chancellor Merkel says she wants a new agreement in Europe that countries will take refugees according to their wealth and their population, so to distribute them fairly is her call here. Does that seem to have a real possibility of going through?
It's hard to say at this point. I mean, she and French President François Hollande have reached that agreement on a permanent and mandatory mechanism to allocate refugees across the EU. And I think Western European countries are, you know, more open to this idea. And we've seen British Prime Minister David Cameron eventually coming out in favor of this. But then you have governments like, you know, we talked about Hungary already, but talk about Poland, talk about Slovakia, who are simply saying, well, these are Muslims. We're not interested in that. And besides that, we will only take a small number. So you have divergent interests, again, to put it mildly here. And as always in Europe, as I said, it will take a long time because the decision-making process is so slow. But that's not what we have.
Long.
That's not what the refugees have right now.
I mean, they have to eat. They have
Absolutely.
To live. They're crowded there. All the TV
Absolutely.
Cameras
and
in
you've
the world
seen there
focused
is a,
on them.
There is a wave of solidarity in parts of Europe, especially southern Germany. You've seen the pictures at the from the train station in Munich, where people leave food and blankets and medication and welcome these refugees.
Yes, I mean, doing their best, that's heartrending in its own way, but clearly not enough. Jack, I want to get to a caller first, Wanda in Keego Harbor, Michigan. Wanda, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I've seen the tragic events on TV and the children, but I've also seen quite a few men. Now, I understand that some of the Republican candidates have talked about the policies of the president.
Okay.
He could have sent troops. Now, somebody needs to help me with this. You have men running from their country. I suggest you train these men to go back and fight. Before one American troop is sent over there, I think these men who have traveled all that distance, you know, they have the stamina, should be trained to go back and fight for their country.
Wanda, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. Jack Beatty, right now they're in the train station in Budapest as refugees. Wanda says turn them around, let them fight for Syria.
Well, some of them, of course, which side will they fight on? We just don't know. You know, Tom, today the vision of a borderless continent, it really looks like a solipsistic project, a feel-good venture of French idealism and German guilt. It worked. The European Union cured the continent of its nationalistic wars. But as so often in history, problems are not so much solved as outgrown, and the answer to one becomes the predicate of another. Islam is a religion of Germany, Chancellor Merkel says nobly. Someday, the question is, will it be the religion of Germany?
Is that really the question? Is that really the question, Jack? Are you serious?
Well, what I'm trying to say, Tom, is that today it's the refugees from war. Tomorrow, it's likely to be the refugees from climate change, and Europe, without its borders, noble idea, is open to all comers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, migrant refugee crisis in Europe. Trump pledging he will not bolt the GOP. He'll be loyal. Kentucky clerk and gay marriage very much in the spotlight this week. And the Iran deal, the nuclear deal, getting the votes lined up that it needs to go through Congress. And so there goes that one. We'll look at it with Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Stefan Groby, Washington correspondent for Euronews. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Where do I go first here? Karen, let me come first to you on Wanda's question. Why shouldn't these guys be home fighting for their country?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to individual circumstances, but the fact is that that war in Syria is really, really complicated
and brutal and long. So many have died.
And that there are a number of factions. It's, very difficult to tell the good guys from the bad guys there. So the question is, they go back and fight for their country. What is their country anymore?
And do you have to sign up for ISIS to do that? Stefan Groby, does Europe look at this and say, we were wrong to stay at arm's length from the conflict in Syria? We needed to be more engaged earlier because now we've got everybody in our lap.
I haven't heard that argument in Europe, from any government. I don't think that European governments are now saying, "Oh, because of the wave of refugees, we have to go back and send European troops there." I think it's rather cynic to say that we should send the Syrian refugees back and tell them, "Well, you better fight." I mean, these are people; these are families that have suffered, incredible loss over the past years, and they are just eager to get out of this.
We've seen the images of the cities in Syria, just shells, skeletons of cities pummeled into dust.
Well, absolutely. And as Karen rightfully said, we don't know where the front lines are. This is a very, very complicated situation. And maybe you just don't want to be you don't want to be taking sides as a family father because, you can be successful one day and then be beheaded the next day. I don't know. I don't think we should send them back.
Jack Beatty, you paint a pretty apocalyptic picture there. It's war now. There could be more wars or spreading wars, climate change to follow. What? How does that affect whether or not Europe hangs together or not? There's still going to be nations and people sitting there facing a potentially very difficult world around Europe.
It's true. It's true. But, you know, we have found out a few things about the European Union. We found out over the Greek crisis that it hadn't really been thought through. It was a financial union, not an economic one. And therefore, it was vulnerable to the kind of crisis we saw in its weakest member, in Greece. And I think something is similar here with this borderless situation, you know, the Schengen idea. Once you're in, you're in. No passports, no. That's a great human achievement in Europe.
It's our achievement in the United States of America. You don't need passports to go from Mississippi to Alabama.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But, you know, we have a border issue much less serious than theirs now. All I'm saying is, Tom, that, you know, the Europeans solved a big problem that had haunted their history, nationalism. But they opened themselves up for another problem, and that is this desperate race for people to get onto the lifeboat of European civilization. And maybe that's all to the good. In any case, it seems to be inevitable.
A year ago, Europe looked at Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey and their struggle with the refugees. Now the refugees are in Europe's lap and the United States is looking on. But chaos breeds the desperate movement of people, and that's clearly what we see here. I want to move, even though those poor refugees in the Budapest train station are not moving anywhere. We're going to move to politics. Donald Trump sat down with the head of the Republican National Committee chair, the Reince Priebus, on just yesterday, and not long after came out to the lobby of Trump Tower to declare that he had signed a loyalty pledge to the GOP. Here's Trump.
I have signed the pledge.
Yeah.
So I will be totally pledging my allegiance to the Republican Party and the conservative principles for which it stands.
Donald Trump. Karen Tumbley, this is a big deal. I mean, after all, the power in his pocket was he could go as an independent. If he didn't get what he wanted within the GOP, he's got the money to do it. And now he's saying he won't do that. Why would Donald Trump make this pledge, Karen?
Well, first of all, it's worth saying that for Republicans here, you know, the good news is that Donald Trump is now bound to the Republican Party. The bad news is that the Republican Party is now bound to Donald Trump. Why would he do this? I was at in Cleveland for the first debate, and one of the first questions was all the candidates were asked whether they would support the Republican nominee, should they not get the nomination. And Donald Trump was the only person who said he wouldn't. He said he wanted to maintain his leverage. On the one hand, that has given him a lot of leverage because the last thing the party wants is him bolting and waging some third-party campaign. But I can tell you that in that audience and among the types of people who traditionally show up for Republican primaries, that was a pretty shocking statement for the kind of – Donald Trump is bringing in a lot of new people who don't necessarily vote all the time. But among the people that you can count on to show up in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada – this was a pretty shocking thing he had done. So I think he was, among other things, trying to undo some damage control of what he'd gotten himself into.
He's a negotiator, in every dimension. So if he's sitting there with Reince Priebus, it's a private meeting. Does he ask for something in return for this? And he's not only signing on to the Republican Party, he's signing on to their conservative principles.
He claims he didn't ask for anything, but don't forget the last private conversation he had had with Reince Priebus had been a couple of months ago when the Republican National Committee chairman had called him up and asked him to please tone it down.
Mm-hmm.
We know how well that worked out.
Sure.
So, this was, I'm sure, a very tense conversation, and it's worth it to remember, this isn't legally binding, this agreement.
Well, of
course. And it's essentially the condition is that Donald Trump continues to believe that he is being treated fairly by the Republican Party.
Jack Beatty, do you take it seriously when he says, I will totally pledging my allegiance to the GOP and the conservative principles? I mean, here he was just recently saying he would raise taxes on hedge fund guys. They just play with money. They get lucky. They don't really produce anything. He's not an orthodox Republican conservative, but he's saying he'll go with conservative principles for which the GOP stands.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Politico said, quote, he thinks he could very well be the GOP nominee. You know, the sane said, oh, he can't win the presidency. But they also said he couldn't dominate the primary, which he's doing. You know, his demagogy really threatens to shipwreck his new party on the shores of America's browning demography. Party strategists say that Republicans need at least 40% of the Hispanic vote to win. Mitt Romney got 27%. Trump's favorables are at 13 and falling. If he wins the nomination, the party to which he's just sworn fealty is likely to forfeit a winnable election. The question is whether his poison has already poisoned the Republican prospects of winning future presidential elections.
I don't know about future elections, but Karen, what about that calculus that Trump can't win in the general election? Does that hold up? If he brings out a kind of populist wave, and let's say already Mitt Romney's support was very, very, very white. Let's say Trump's is even whiter, but he brings out more of it. I mean, he's got passionate followers right now. Is there still a way to general election? Is there any way for general election victory for this candidate?
You know, I have given up predicting anything about involving Donald Trump. It does not appear that he could possibly win a general election, but we don't know who the Democratic nominee is going to be. We don't know what the public mood is going to be. I must say, though, it is, to Jack's point about demography, I mean, one of the things he did this week was criticize Jeb Bush for speaking Spanish and said he should be conducting all of his interviews in English. This is Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida, in turn accused Donald Trump of issuing a racial dog whistle. So this is going to be ugly.
I think that's more than a dog whistle. Stefan Grobe, you're watching this as a German, as a European. Europe has plenty of right-wing parties that have really gained momentum in recent years. Do you recognize that in Donald Trump?
No, not at all. I mean, he makes the whole thing very colorful. Right now, there is no real interest in Europe in the presidential campaign in the United States. It's way too early if you think that, you know, European countries have a much, much shorter campaign period. In Britain, it's 6 weeks or so.
But you don't see him as akin to the white nationalists in Europe.
Well, he's a television guy, right? He's a TV reality guy.
So what? They can win. They did in Europe, in your continent, in Italy.
We had people like Berlusconi or Sarkozy in France who were, not that telegenic maybe, but they had their followers. So I think, it was quite telling that the RNC chairman traveled to New York to Trump Tower like an impoverished pilgrim to speak to Donald Trump, not the other way around.
Through the golden doors.
And I can only say to him, you know, be careful what you wish for. Yeah. And as Karen has pointed out rightfully, they might be forced to, support him and his unorthodox ideas, I should say, when push comes to shove.
Trump,
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure that the assumption is correct that he cannot be the nominee. I don't see who else. I mean, America talks about one guy right now, and that's Donald Trump. Who else? Look at all these sitting governors and senators, you know, accomplished politicians who score between 0 and 5% in the polls. So
that's calling it plainly as
amazing.
It is. And Trump saying loyal to the GOP. Nick in Brookline, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Nick. You're on the air. What do you think of that move?
Brilliant, brilliant politics. Really brilliant politics, to tell you the truth, because he's so cocky and he's so arrogant, and people feed off of that. I'm a liberal Democrat, and my mother and my whole family are liberal Democrats for the last 20 years, and my mom's completely captivated by this guy just because of this populist kind of mentality.
Captivated as in she would support him? She would vote for him?
Yeah, I was in a state of shock when she said it. But I think all of the populism that he's been pumping out, plus he's all over the place, so you can believe anything you want. You know, you can believe he's going to tax, you can believe he's not going to tax. He's really set himself up to be both amorphous and telegenic. And when you have those two things together, you have a potential president. So it's really sad.
It's riveting, that's for sure. Nick, I appreciate your call. I mean, Jeb Bush picking this week to take the gloves off, saying Donald Trump is a kind of the end is near guy. He's all pessimistic, Jeb Bush says. He's negative. All of us will suffer if that philosophy gains favor, you heard Jeb Bush say. Pretty direct attack. Here he was at that same town hall meeting in Hampton, New Hampshire, just yesterday.
And there's one candidate in the Republican Party that is preying on people's angst and fears.
Karen, what do you make of Jeb Bush's attack this week? Can he get in the ring with Donald Trump and do the tough stuff? Does his message have wings?
Well, when Jeb Bush got in this race as the presumed establishment favorite, he said he wasn't going to run for president if he could not do it with joy. It looks like you look out there on the campaign trail, and the only buddy who's having any kind of joy or a good time is Donald Trump at the moment. So yes, he has had to switch strategies. He really didn't have much of a choice. His donors were demanding it. And it's just going to be a different kind of race, I think, than Jeb Bush anticipated.
Boy, that's a game that Trump can play well. I think his response was, oh, that's just sad. Jeb Bush is just sad. Pretty tough to fight with that. On the other side of the party line here, we've got Joe Biden's very publicly out there this week, kind of in decision mode about whether or not to run. He was in Atlanta last night, and here he is talking about whether or not he runs, saying it depends on what's best for his family and whether he has the emotional energy to run.
The most relevant factor in my decision is whether my family and I have the emotional energy to run.
Jack Beatty, if you're asking that question, does that mean no? That you're not. If you're asking if you have the emotional energy, can you possibly really be, if that's a real question, can you really be considering a run?
It doesn't sound that way. And yet, as people look at his schedule, where he's going, Pennsylvania, Florida, I'm sure New Hampshire, I'm sure he's going to be on national television, the Colbert Report next week. It looks like he's getting ready for something. And there was a clear hint dropped just the other day in a Globe interview with Elizabeth Warren. We remembered that Biden met with her in a dramatic meeting on a Saturday, and she was asked, was there any talk about a joint ticket with Joe Biden? And she said something like, well, it was a very long conversation. Well, that's what you call a kind of hint. And, you know, the Democratic, I won't say panic, but fear that they have a prime candidate who's hobbled by a habit of self-subversion, Hillary Clinton, that fear is mounting, and it's going to get worse. I mean, it can't help a candidate to have her former technical aide having to plead the fifth in front of a congressional hearing. We'll see that
around
on our television.
Around the email issue.
And all of this is going to keep coming out, and all of it self-caused by Mrs. Clinton's habitual secrecy and really her royalism, her belief that rules don't apply to her. So I don't know. I mean, you could see Joe feeling the hints are that kind of admission says no. The hints, his schedule, say possibly.
Karen Tumbley, do the math for us. There's Hillary Clinton. There's Bernie Sanders with a lot of momentum. There's Joe Biden. X plus Y equals what?
Well, the absolute nightmare scenario for Hillary Clinton would be for Joe Biden to get in the race, take enough votes from her to allow Bernie Sanders to win Iowa and New Hampshire, and then for Biden to come back and win South Carolina. Now, this is a far-fetched, I'm doing war games here. But it's, this has got to be the kind of thing that they're worrying about in Brooklyn, where the Clinton headquarters is.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Yeezy for president. During MTV's Video Music Awards, Kanye West said he wants a seat, the seat, in the Oval Office.
And yes, as you probably could have guessed by this moment, I have decided in 2020 to run for president.
Okay, the NFL's Tom Brady gets off scot-free in Deflategate. He'll play from day one next week. Sports columnist for USA Today, Christine Brennan.
If you're a Patriots fan, you love Brady, and you're cheering today. If you're around the rest of the country, you're wondering, hey, did a cheater just get away with this?
And director Wes Craven died at 76. He redefined the slasher film with his movie Nightmare on Elm Street and made horror films moneymakers. We spoke with him in 2013.
Horror films and terror films tend to deal with things that are very primal and have a history that goes back to our very beginning as an entity, as an individual.
Horror all over the place. Karen Tubley is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Stefan Groby is with us, Washington correspondent for Euro News, watching both the refugee migrant crisis in Europe and everything unfolding in the United States. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Kentucky. Bob in Jamestown, Kentucky, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. A little background on this situation. This judge here in this case is David Bunning. He's the son of Jim Bunning, a former baseball pitcher. Okay. And U.S. Senator from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He was kind of caught in a hard place with this kind of sentencing meted out. If he was just going to fine Kim Davis, there's enough internet support and GoFundMe that she wouldn't have been any kind of problem
right.
paying a fine.
Yep.
But he decided to go ahead and give her the jail sentence. Now, local TV media looked into the background, just who is Kim Davis? Kim Davis has been married 4 times.
So what?
Certainly an expert on marriage, I guess, being 4 times.
Twice to the same guy. But so what, Bob? What's the issue? A lot of people have been married more than once.
I mean, here she's, you know, wanting to deny and deny people the right to marriage to the Supreme Court law. I mean, she thinks she's above the law. I mean, there's three clerks in Kentucky right now that are opposed to this. And by the way, people got married this morning up there in Rowan County. All five of the deputy clerks went ahead and agreed to it, except Kim Davis' son, who is a deputy clerk, and he still refuses to sign the marriage certificate.
You've got three more clerks in Kentucky who are opposed to gay marriage. Do you think they'll march off to jail, join Kim in a cell?
They ought to. I mean, you know, what's good for one is good for them all. Put them all in there.
But, you know, you say she says she's above the law. She says she's responding to a higher law, God's authority.
Yeah. Well, what about the Bible verse that says cleave unto your husband? And he's been married, divorced 3 times.
Fair enough. Cleave unto your husband. The Bible speaks. Bob, I really appreciate your call. Here's a little sound of Kim Davis earlier this week in Rowan County, Kentucky, interacting with a couple. They're trying to get their marriage license. She refuses to serve them.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage license today.
Why?
Pending
in contempt of court.
What appeal is left?
Pending the appeal
it's
in the Sixth
denied.
Circuit. We are not issuing marriage license today.
So based on what?
I would ask you all to
why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under
why?
Whose authority
whose
are you
authority?
Not issuing license?
Under God's authority.
Under God's authority. Outside there, the office, though, well, here's the chant.
This is not a church. This is not a church.
Go to Jovain in Lancaster, South Carolina. Jovain, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
I want to call in give a little bit of clarity on it because people are thinking that the church and the government are one. And to shine light on, you have to study our history from the 1700s up to the 1900s. Mm-hmm. Some of those laws are still govern us now. But to get to the point is the judges have ruled right. Because the government itself is set up for a contract, which is a civil marriage. She is wrong but she is right because she feels as though God did not set this up. But when you look at the way the law is set up, she has to initiate a marriage license because it is set up as a government to do business. If two trees could sign their name on a contract, they could be married. If you go out to the store and buy bubblegum, they give you a receipt. It's a contract. You have to study contract law. But now you look
at it's civil, but it's a civil marriage. I think that you put your finger on the heart of it right there, Gervain. This is not, and in that simple factual way, the protesters are correct. The county clerk's office is not a church, or as one of them who came in demanding marriage this week said, this is not a temple, this is not a mosque, it's not a church. This is a civil setting. But she was bringing her religious faith right in there. But Gervain, you're right. We've got a separation of church and state. She didn't want to go there. Caroline in Austin, Texas. Karen.
Tom, this is, I think in this one, because she is a civil servant, the issues are pretty clear. But when the Supreme Court issued its decision on gay marriage, I think there's probably types of cases coming down the road that are going to be a little bit less clear. For instance, if you're a religious college, do you have to, and, don't believe in gay marriage as part one of your tenets, do you have to offer married student housing to gay couples?
Is that applicable here? This isn't a religious anything. This is a fully civil office.
But what I'm saying is that this case is going to open up the potential for cases that are sort of a lot closer to the line, I think, than this one. And they're out there, and I think they're coming down the road.
Noland and
Noor. Can I weigh in here, Tom? Yes. I love this story because for a foreign correspondent, this is one of the stories where, that caters to the European notion that sometimes Americans are living on a different planet. This is a public servant, right? And as a public servant, you're not entitled to an opinion. You have to be neutral. So you have to abide by the law.
That's kind of a European perspective right there, I would say.
Well, I guess it's Lindsey Graham was, I think he was the only one, maybe Carly Fiorina as well, who came out defending the judge's action here because they were saying, the rule of law is the rule of law, and the law of the land is the law of the land. This has become a bold statement for Republican politicians, which is quite remarkable, right?
Yeah.
So there is no room for a religious opinion here. And if you want to practice, and all this, all this nonsense about Americans or Christians are persecuted in the United States, this is nonsense. If you don't like your job, do something else. But if you're a public servant, you are you're not entitled to a personal opinion.
Well, I would say there's always room for a personal opinion, but you may have to pay a price, and she's paying it right now. She's in jail. Jack, what do you see here?
Well, I was just going to pick up on what Stefan said.
Yes.
Mike Huckabee, on the other hand, applauded her for, quote, not bowing to the false god of judicial supremacy. Well, in Marbury v. Madison, 1803, Chief Justice Marshall laid it down, quote, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. That's been American constitutional practice since 1803.
That's a long time. Caroline, Austin, Texas, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I just had a thought that if you had a Quaker who had the same office and issued clerks to gun owners, but because he was a peace officer, he wouldn't do that. He would say it was against his morals. Do you understand?
I'm not sure that I do. Do you think she should be able to stand there and deny marriages, or should she
I'm saying just the opposite. That if she were not so-called Christian, if she identified herself as a peaceful, loving Quaker, and then someone came in and wanted to buy a gun permit, in her mind, she'd have to say no. So I'm saying that she's totally dead wrong, and I'm so glad to see her get her just desserts.
I mean, the judge didn't have a lot of options here. She's an elected official. The only way that she'd be removed, I guess, is by impeachment. I don't know if there's any guarantee that she would be impeached by the citizens of her community there. Stefan, to your point about personal opinion and religion and public life, I mean, in this country, that can play in lots of ways. Ben Carson is doing very well in the polls now, tied with Trump in one Iowa poll, gaining on him in others. He talks about his faith all the time. Here he was on the campaign trail in Iowa just this week, Ben Carson.
We have to stop listening to these people who tell us that we cannot talk about God, we cannot talk about our faith.
So there it is, right in the middle. Yeah.
And again, in Europe, you would have no politician whatsoever who would talk about his faith, his or her faith, and it's simply not an issue.
Another planet, as
when
you say.
It's a different environment, yeah. So when we as a foreign correspondent have to look at the campaign, we're always amazed by the amount of energy, the amount of time and that is spent in campaigns on faith issues here. And Ben Carson is a great argument because he is one of the fellows who has no political experience, together with Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina, and he is pretty good in the polls right now.
Yes,
and
he is.
That's
welcome
an
to
interesting,
America, Stefan.
That's an interesting, an interesting observation. You add up the poll numbers of Trump, Carson, and Fiorina, and you end up with more than 50%. So that's quite telling.
Of course, Trump, he seems very, very not too deep in the religion category.
Well, but he's somebody who has never held elective office. That's what I'm saying. But
Karen, I hear you there.
Well, you've also seen polls, though, where you ask people, mm-hmm. what candidate qualities are disqualifying. Would you vote for a divorced person? Would you vote for this? Would you vote for that? And consistently, when they ask people, would you vote for a candidate for president who is a declared atheist, you see a lot of public resistance. In this country, people don't necessarily want their president to be of their own faith, but they are more comfortable with a president who is of some faith.
Yet another way in which Donald Trump is very intriguing. Black Lives Matter, Freddie Gray, Baltimore, all of that. On Wednesday, we had about 100 protesters outside the Baltimore courthouse. First hearing in the case of six city police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray was held, and protesters out in force.
All night, all day, we will fight for Freddie Gray. All night, all day, we will fight for Freddie Gray.
The police do not care about black lives. The cameras don't care about black lives.
There will be six individual trials for those officers, and a lot of attention will follow that. But this interesting development here where there's a line now coming out of Fox News and conservative quarters against Black Lives Matter. We've seen some police shootings this week, Fox Lake, know it well, folks in the family there, and dear memories there, but this week it wasn't pretty. You had at the National Press Club on Wednesday, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley joining a kind of chorus of Republicans critical now of the Black Lives Matter movement. Nikki Haley.
Black lives do matter, and they have been disgracefully jeopardized by the movement that has laid waste to Ferguson and Baltimore. There's a tendency to falsely equate noise with results. Some people think you have to yell and scream in order to make a difference.
She's talking about results, but it got closer to beginning to blame it for police shootings. Interview with Texas news station KHOU on Tuesday. Ted Cruz, Republican senator, of course, out of Texas, presidential hopeful, said the Obama administration's rhetoric could be linked to hostility toward police, like the shooting of a Houston area sheriff's deputy in August.
Over and over again, President Obama and the Department of Justice and senior administration officials have chosen to vilify law enforcement.
Jack, this is pretty interesting, coming back, going after Black Lives Matter.
Yes, but just on Cruz, I'll get to that. Mm. President Obama called the slain officer's widow, this was the Texas sheriff, on Monday, and he issued a statement saying, quote, Michelle and I would keep her and her family in our prayers. So just the complete opposite of what Senator Cruz said. And, this apparently started this meme of, Black Lives Matter as what Bill O'Reilly calls a hate group. It started from a chant that was heard at a Minnesota State Fair last week, and the chant was, pigs in blanket, fry 'em like bacon. Well, okay, that was a chant.
I don't even get it.
I don't even get it myself. I guess maybe it alludes to the pork on display. Who knows? But anyway, it was seized on as showing, you see this? They're calling for the death of the Black Lives Matter people.
I see.
Calling for the death of policemen. Policemen are killed. Cause and effect. There's no cause and effect. I mean, my gosh, Black Lives Matter is trying to draw attention to a long-standing violation of civil rights, and it is part, as the New York Times says today, of the tradition, belongs to the tradition of the civil rights movement. It isn't provoking violence. On the other hand, Anthony Batt, the former Baltimore policeman, was police commissioner, was quoted this week as saying that the crime rate has gone up in Baltimore partly because the police are leery of further charges against them.
So, hey, Jack, I have to take it to Karen for just a moment. The nuclear deal, Karen. We're told now there are enough votes in the Senate to uphold an Obama veto of any congressional disapproval. Does that mean it's done? The Iran nuclear deal will go through as negotiated.
It does look pretty done, and this has been a huge setback for AIPAC, the formidable Israeli lobby in Washington. They made a number of miscalculations. One is they expected the intensity around this issue to be much greater than it turned out to be. I think there was also, there was a Trump factor here. People just weren't paying attention.
What a giant losing bet they made, and all the bad blood between Washington and Israel around this. I don't know where that goes, but kind of remarkable. Any way around it, or is this just done, Karen?
It looks pretty done at this point. And, again, it's just also a big setback and a backlash against Bibi Netanyahu for that speech that he came to the House and gave.
On the floor of the U.S. Congress, but a win for the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear deal front. Karen Tumbledy, national political correspondent with The Washington Post. It's always terrific to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stefan Groby, Washington correspondent for Euronews. Good luck with your problems in Europe, and please come again, Stefan, to talk with us.
Absolutely, Tom. It was great. Thank you.
Jack Beattie, great to have you as always. Good Labor Day weekend to all. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.